Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, your host Tiff Stevenson, the podcast where we talk to comedians, writers, actors, directors, filmmakers about the art, comedy, film and TV that's been revolutionary to them. Joining me on today's show, she is a creator, writer, comedian, stand-up, performer, actress, I was going to say polymath, friend. She's all of those things. It's Roisin Connaughty. Yay!
Hello.
Hello. See how I struggled to go, what am I going to say first? Like, which of the things am I going to say? Because you've done a lot. But the reason I've invited you on the podcast is because you've been a tiny revolution to me.
Oh.
So I want to know all about your tiny revolutions. So with saying that, are you happy with all of those descriptions? Or is there anything I've missed out when I introduced you?
My dancing, my singing, my advice giving, my general. No, I think you covered it pretty much there very generously. No, yeah, it's fine. All of that was good. I like creator. It makes you sound a bit godlike. What do you do? Create. Thanks. What do you do?
I did think that. I was like, well, you know, birthing universes, which we will talk about.
Well, that's a great way to describe it. You're right. Well, you could call it that, or you could call it birthing universes, whatever fits in the box.
Go with what you're happy with. So my first question for you is, how did you become this? Was this like design or happy accident? How did you become Roisin Connaughty, creator, performer, etc., that you are today?
I've always been interested in you know, comedy and art and music and film and stuff to a very obsessive degree. If I liked something, I really liked it. And I loved movies and films and books in a way. You know, I like escaping. If I can get out of my own head, I was always happier if I wasn't in my own head. And art and literature and music helps you do that, and film and writing. And I wanted to be a country and western singer when I was a child. And
love it.
Yeah. And I used to write very long country and western songs. And I didn't really understand that you could skip time in a song. Like that you could. So if the song started in the morning, I had to work through every beat of the day. Like, I didn't really understand that you could just be like, you could just say how you felt without explaining where you were. So I remember the look on my mum's face whenever I had a new sort of symphony for her to get involved in. And then when I got to about 12 or 13, my cousin's boyfriend, I sung to him. And then he said, oh, yes, it's not a bad song, actually. And he said, shame you haven't got a voice. And I remember being like, oh, how funny. And then I left the room and dramatically leaned against the wall and slid down it. Like in a movie, like my whole world collapsed. I was like, well, if I'm not going to be a country and west singer, I'm going to have to get a job. Then I sort of lost faith in performing and I just thought, oh, I'm going to be, that's not what I want to do. And I sort of had a disdain for it because maybe secretly I wanted to do it. And so I distrusted anyone who wanted to perform. I thought it was all a bit like, ugh, how needy, secretly wanted to do it. And then I did theatre studies instead of performing arts. And so I didn't have to perform really, but bar the odd thing. And then I did film at uni. And I remember having this sort of, you know, it was a perfect degree, and you go in and you watch movies and discuss movies and write about movies. And then I had this feeling, I was like, you want to perform, you know? And I was like, oh no, I do want to perform and I want to write and create and all of that. But I did. And that was sort of a big awakening then. And but stand up, I'd always been, you know, like, obviously some people disagree, but screw them. I'd always been funny. And that was sort of my go-to emotion, you know, like I've always, that's just a play. I think I'd always sort of loved making people laugh. It was a thing I found quite intoxicating, and I love laughing, which sounds like a really simple statement, but I don't think everyone does, to the point of,
right,
not everyone really wants to laugh that much. They find it a little bit invasive if you keep trying to make them laugh. And yeah, so, and then I went for a pizza and my friend Danielle said to me, you should do stand-up. It was one person. There wasn't loads of people telling me the whole time. It's one person.
I love that it's one person at these key moments. One person said, you haven't got a voice. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you were like, done. One person said you should do stand-up, done.
I mean, that's all. I'm very susceptible to any. And then I went to downstairs at the King's Head and I put my name down, and it was all very, I didn't know about the Edinburgh Festival, I didn't know about it as a career. I saw a very sort of, you know, standard, you know, ropey open mic night, and I thought, well, it's lucky I'm here. It looks like this. Like, I genuinely was like, well, this isn't great. I mean, they must be needing a new batch. Like, this is terrible if this is what. And then I went to, you know, when I went on the circuit and started seeing actually really brilliant, like Mickey Flanagan compared my first open mic at Amused Moves. I remember thinking, dear Lord, this man, like, how can he not be all over television? He was very soon after. But, you know, you go into a circuit where there's like an amazing amount of talent just because you haven't seen them on TV. I was like, but at the beginning, what got me through was just seeing an open mic night. Never been to one before, and thinking, well, yes, I can see why I'm here.
Any of the early stuff that you watched in terms of films, because you said as a kid, if you were obsessed with something, so it was like country music. Mm. Was there any film or any stand-ups or anything like that who, before you did stand-up, sort of inspired that journey then? That journey via film into stand-up?
So much, I think. And it's so interesting because there's sort of so much discourse around influences that sometimes I had to sort of almost go back and really work out what were my influences rather than the ones sort of that we discuss quite a lot. And I definitely think, like, one that it took me a while to sort of recognise, but Blossom, the TV show Blossom.
Right, right.
That had a huge, huge impact on me and how I saw myself and how I saw being funny. And I don't ever acknowledge it because it's not a show that gets discussed like that, maybe, you know, in that way in this country. But it was on at 6 p.m. on a Friday. And the opening episode, the pilot, maybe the opening scene, it's her sort of holding a hairbrush, talking to a video camera as if she's doing sort of the opening monologue on a sort of night show, a Saturday night show or an evening show. And it was written like those monologues, like a full of jokes and gags. And it just, so looking back, it looked like it was stand-up, you know, watching. And this show was like, you know, her brother's an alcoholic, her mum doesn't love her. And it was really funny. She had a stupid brother like Joey, who was very similar to the Joey character that ended up in Friends. And yeah, it was, I really loved it. And I loved the sort of storylines of it, that it did try and deal with issues, quote, quote, you know, and it was funny. And I just hadn't seen that a girl could be the centre of a story, that her wants and needs, and she could be funny and she could be the love interest. And yeah, it really blew my mind. I think, and you know, it took me a long time to sort of, but when I see the show, I get such a physical reaction to, like, Blossom, you know, like I identified with her so much.
I do remember fancying the brother, but actually now you've mentioned it, that's probably the early, maybe the first example of a himbo.
Yeah.
That we saw, and so almost subverting that, you know.
Totally.
It was like the good looking guy's the idiot.
And just the older brother was this alcoholic who'd got out of rehab, and you know, just the fact she had this space, it was just very, it was complex. And it was on at 6 p.m. on Channel 4, and she was funny and she was witty and she had the lines, and she was going through all the stuff I was going through at the time, you know, being a teenager. And you know, it was really, and it was really great writing, really great. It holds up as well. I watched it recently and I was like, this show holds up, you know. And yeah, so that was one of the shows. The Golden Girls, I loved. Only Fools and Horses. So many of those sort of shows, but like, they get discussed, I guess. But Blossom is one that I I feel like never, I don't feel like gets its sort of, you know, credit. And I think my generation, I think, you know, we used to be like run home to watch it at 6 o'clock on a Friday, you know, it was.
Yeah. And look at like how Six was like styling her hair and doing her makeup as well. I remember that.
Yeah, they're all amazing.
That's such a great answer. And there's probably film and magazines and smash hits and all of that.
All of it. You know, I watched and I was just obsessed with it all, you know, I used to buy the National Enquirer when I was like 9.
I love this. This is hysterical to me. Like at 9 years old.
10, whenever it came out. So because I'd get through magazines so fast. So like I'd get through Smash Hits, get through Just, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. And then I got to like, maybe I was like 10 or 11. Less 9's probably exaggerating. But like, and I just see these, and I didn't know who any of these Americans were, but I just liked the print in the world. And I was sort of obsessed with that sort of, you know, the movies and glamour. And but I used to watch a lot of Hammer horrors. That was the thing I was really into. So horror film, horrors, that would be a thing my dad would watch. Same thing with Vincent Price, all of those. But movie wise, you know, all this, there's great, amazing movies, you know, Steel Magnolias, all the, anything with a lot, you know, Postcards from the Edge. Just as I'm getting older, female led stuff always obviously sometimes resonated with me a bit more. But only Fools and Horses, you know, I think sometimes the art, you know, it, you kind of remember whether how much you liked it or whether it was the time and who you watched it with, you know. And Only Fools and Horses was such a joyous moment in our home when it was on, like everyone was up for it, you know. So my mum and my dad, everything sort of lift, the mood lifted, and I saw the power of comedy when those shows that everyone agreed on, which I know a lot of people hate a lot of those shows, but they do, they're powerful forces in homes when everyone goes.
Oh, they were big in our house, yeah. As well, it was a treat to sit down and watch Fools,
yeah.
And also I do think there was something in the hopefulness of the characters.
Oh yeah,
you were like, what are they going to do now? And you really wanted it to work out for them, but at the same time, you know, like, what was Del Boy going to do next? Like, what schemes he getting up to now, you know? And I think as well, you know, the Britishness of it, I think recognizing, you know, that sort of aspect, I suppose, of, because there was a lot of American sitcoms as well, and they always felt slightly more aspirational to me with high school and everything else. But there was something just so deeply, like you felt like you knew the people.
I mean, 100%. It was so working class. It was so generational, you know, to see. And they dealt with it, you know, this sort of, you know, you've got the old guy and then the new guy, you know, Rodney's trying to, you know, get to college. And, you know, sort of how even within a family, within a generation, you know, people's values change. You know, Rodney wanted to not be this dodgy, you know, but there was so much joy. I felt like it felt like it was a very joyous show, you know, and it really knitted its plots together very well. And I feel like, you, like exactly what you said, you really rooted for the characters. And when Rodney felt shame or hard done by, you bought it and you knew Rodney's not going to like this, you know, like, and, you know, and you knew Del Boy never had a good idea in his life, you know, and but you know, he loved everyone and you sort of
and that dynamic as well with the older brother feeling like I got to take care of my younger brother.
Totally. And the judgment that you can have when you're the judgment of how you judge the people, the caregivers, when they've had to make these difficult decisions and, you know, get by, and, you know, and you know, you can be a bit pure when you're like, that's not how you should do it, and you go, well, you're not the one who had to earn the money, you know, sort of. So but I just loved it. I loved that show. And I loved that, you know, those shows that sort of changed the moods in homes, especially, you know, that didn't show the world completely different to the one you knew, you know, but they still brought joy. It wasn't like, oh, look, you know, we're in Dallas, or, you know, which I loved as well and stuff. But yeah, Only Fools and Horses was a sort of one. And you know what I really loved as well? Birds of a Feather.
Oh, yeah.
What'll I do
when you are far away? I've watched that with my mum. Yeah, we loved that.
I really loved that. Cheers. And just, I watch, you know, get into sort of all kinds of, you know, all the big ones I'd love, you know. Cell Block H was a big one, I think, for me. I used to pretend, so it would be on Thursday night at like 11:30 at night. And every Thursday night, like 11:15, I'd get up and I'd be like, I'm hungry. Because I knew my mum would be watching. And then I'd just take ages to eat a bowl of cereal so I could see what was happening in prison cell block age.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Earliest political memory, was it like seeing Thatcher on the TV or...?
I think it was probably Margaret Thatcher, and my parents are Irish and I was, you know, an Irish name. So I remember it being around that sort of conversation. Yeah, it was Thatcher and maybe an election, like Neil Kinnock. I remember that sort of discussion and taking away the milk for schools. It's sort of a blur into one. So I don't have a, you know, like it gets clearer as I get older, but I remember sort of hearing anti-Thatcher, anti-conservative sort of stuff in every sort of area I went to, I guess. Yeah, that's my sort of earliest memory.
Yeah, like mine, I think, was Thatcher and remembering having milk at school and then not having milk at school. And then my mum being angry, but not really understanding what had happened.
Yeah, that's exactly sort of what I remember. I remember having milk and then not having milk. And then, but just sort of hearing, well, my mum's called Margaret, being like, are you Margaret Thatcher? Not really understanding that two people could be called Margaret.
Right.
You know, just not understanding that two people could have the same name. So I was very young. But yeah, but I guess, you know, it's sort of woman that, you know, everyone seems to dislike. And you just remember, I just remember her image, like the blue suit and all of that. And just sort of that, you know, when you can't comprehend what, you know, the details of politics at that age, you're just watching a woman who just seems to be smiling and speaking that everyone's like, like
what's going on?
Yeah, you know.
You mentioned Irishness. Like, do you say like you're London Irish? Do you consider that to be part of your, or is that a weird?
Oh yeah, I think, you know, I've got an Irish identity. Like my parents are Irish. I was born here, but, you know, spent a lot of my time in Ireland and, you know, that sort of, so I consider myself Irish. I'm a Londoner, you know, like definitely. But yeah, it does, you know, my parents were immigrants. So like, even though it doesn't seem, it's not that far, but they were from a very different culture at the time, you know, cultures change and, you know, the Irish culture and English culture, you know, to the outsider now seem very similar, and they are a lot more similar than they were. And, but it was, you know, I felt like I had parents who weren't from here, you know, like, and especially in the '80s and the '90s, it felt a bit, you know, with all the, you know, the political situation, the terrorism, and felt very different. And my name, you know, so I've got a name that sort of announces my, it's quite a strange thing because, you know, it announces that you're Irish, you know, before you say anything. So, yeah, so I feel very connected to that culture. You know, I feel very connected to English culture, but I do feel, you know, that's because where my parents are from. I feel like Ireland is always, when I get there, I feel like, oh, home is that sort of, but I'm very much a Londoner. And I think any time you have two cultures, I do think, you know, it affects the work because there's two different value sets at different times, you know. My mum's from this tiny village in Ireland. I mean, their song is There's Only One Street in Drumcolaha. And so I think that's, I tell you what's affected my, I would say, outlook or art is that I grew up in a council estate. It's very colourful and loud and all different cultures and all different smells and noise and, you know, all of it, every bit of life in, you know, very tightly packed in. And you live there and then you go to Ireland for like 3 months and you're just in a field and it's like no one's trying to entertain you, no one gives a shit like what you do. And not in an unloving way, in a kind of like, you know, go and make, you know, make entertainment for yourself, what are you going to do? And And I think that sort of is my personality now. I'm either all like, and then I need 2 months in a field. You know, like I need, that's the only way I can exist.
You need solitary.
Yeah,
solitary,
like complete extremes, you know.
That's interesting, because I do think Irishness runs through, but obviously because there's that great tradition, I suppose, of Irish storytelling and comedy and everything else, and that Irish people can spin a yarn. For me, whenever I hear an Irish name in comedy, I'm like, it's going to be quality. Like, I, you know, I always know that it's going to be, I'm in for...
They're very funny and they are good. You know, I don't have, you know, especially, you know, Irish born people, they're very funny. They, like, this is, you know, gross generalizations. Of course, there's some bores, but I'd say on the whole, they're very funny, very charming, and they can hold a tale. And I think, you know, there's some, I have my own theories that are probably absolute bullshit, but I think they're big families. You had to earn your place to speak, you know, kind of someone's going to talk, so you better be interesting, you know, sort of. And obviously, because English isn't their first language, they've created with it. The really great Irish comedians and writers, I think they use the language really beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not including myself in that, by the way, so I'm not a lunatic. I'm literally talking about people.
I would include you. But I know what you mean. It's the difference. I tell you what, as well, like someone like Tommy Tiernan, seeing him in the UK and then seeing him in front of an Irish audience, it's just like there's a, it's almost like a tissue. It's like connective tissue.
Yeah.
And he's brilliant here. And like he's done Old Rope and he's been brilliant here. Yeah. But I'm like, oh, it's like blood flowing. Like it's such a visceral, like.
Well, it feels in Ireland, he's almost a valve for the country itself, you know, at periods of time, like, you know, Tommy speaks and the country sighs, you know, it's felt like that at a time. I think he's been such a, you know, like Dave Allen and people like that who become sort of, you know, not always, but, you know, they become sort of the mouthpiece, a bit of the person in the country, you know, who's like, this is what we think or feel. Or, and comedy does that. It provides that sort of, you know, like someone said, or, you know, I feel seen or whatever. And Tommy, you know, he's magnificent at what he does. And yeah, he's tremendous. Dylan Moran, there's so many, you know, amazing Irish comedians. Aisling.
Do you think Ireland respects comedy more than somewhere like England? I feel like in Ireland, there's an inherent, it's so much part of daily life. Like I've seen newspapers quote The Simpsons and Tommy Tiernan in the same news story. So I feel like there's a respect for it as an art form that I maybe think England doesn't have as much. I could be wrong.
I'm not sure. Honestly, I feel like, you know, obviously Edinburgh's in the UK, Edinburgh Festival. So I think England, the UK has got a huge respect, I think, in a way, like for comedy. I do think there is a, you know, Oxford and Cambridge, the fact that so many of our comedians are from the, you know, the elite sort of parts of society show that it's not a thing that, you know, is where you, you know, it's seen as something worth doing.
Right.
I think Ireland, I think I would definitely say in social situation, like it's seen as, you know, to be funny and to laugh and to try and be funny and to try and participate is seen as very good manners, and you need to be able to do that. I would say this is, again, you know, I think it's seen as good form, you know, that you should be able to make light of yourself and not be too big and not, you know, like it's right. Not seen as, I don't think seriousness, even though they are a very serious people, but I think seriousness isn't seen as noble, you know. There's a kind of like, we don't, you know, we'll laugh about it, whatever it is, good or bad. It's seen as, you know, I've got to Ireland, I get into a taxi, and by the time I get to the gig, I'm like, what am I doing here? This taxi driver's funnier than me. Everyone's funnier than me. Like, why am I in this country? why have they booked me?
Let's get into Game Face, because obviously having been in it as well, but I have lots of thoughts about this. If there's someone listening who hasn't seen Game Face, go watch Game Face. One of the beautiful things about it is it deals with lots of really important stuff, but with such a lightness of touch that it's really, really beautifully done. So first question, I guess, is what was your aim when you started writing and making the show? Like, did you have a mission statement behind it?
Basically, no, the mission statement, I guess I wanted to write a show about a woman who I wanted to, like, she's at that point in her life where things haven't worked out. Her dreams haven't materialised. Her relationship that she's put 12 years in is gone. And that bit where, you know, you're in your 30s and this, it hasn't landed, and you sort of are where you were maybe or worse than you were when you were 21, you know, but with more baggage and a bit less faith that things are going to work out. So that was sort of it. I wanted it to be funny, obviously, because it was a sitcom, comedy drama. And then I think you start trying to write and, you know, it's hard and you can get caught up in how people are going to respond to your show, and those thoughts are never useful. To sort of help me create it, I guess I wanted it to be a show that sort of had some joy in it, that brought joy and people were able to and connection, that feeling, because that's sort of the stuff I love. So I don't want to sound too pretentious, but the stuff I watch again and again is like stuff that I feel connected to, and characters I feel connected to, and that I feel nourishes me. And I wanted to do that, whether I achieve that or not, I want it to be quite nourishing as opposed to depleting.
Oh, you did. Oh. You so did. You so achieved something that was, I think one of the reasons we love Marcella is because we are Marcella, or we all, you know, she's someone who's funny and smart, but she's an optimist as well. She's in a place, but she hasn't given up, and she's still, but she's also a realist. She's not like out of her mind because she's talented. So of course she can get things, and she's a realist in that there's that horrible moment where she, you know, they're splitting the bill, for example, one of the many moments where I think people were like, oh, I'm just trying to achieve my dreams and I want everyone to think I'm great. And then I turn up at this thing and now I've got this moment where I'm just hoping that no one realizes how like thin the ice is that I'm standing on.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that thing of, you know, and I think that's why it's called game face. You have to put that face onto the world. And I think a lot of, you know, we all do it, you know, wherever it is, when there's a bit, when you are seen as a proper adult and you should have your stuff together. And these are kind of broad tropes, but then the details of what makes, I think, the difference between a good version and a bad version of, because, you know, there's only so many stories in a human life, which is, are you where you want to be? Are you happy? You know, can you change? Do you believe you can change? And they're the sort of questions I think Marcella is in that moment where she can go either way. Like, is she going to lose faith that she is the creator of her own destiny and she can, you know, that she can change and she can make better decisions for herself? Or is she going to lean into, you know, I'm not, this is it for her, you know, and just be a receiving mode of life, you know, where you just like, oh, I'll just do whatever falls into my lap. So it's quite interesting because that's, I think wherever you are in your life, you can sort of relate to that. You're just like, oh, you know, how you doing? You know, like, how you doing right now, wherever you are, you know, is it what you're going to be doing? You know, have you tried your hardest? That sort of stuff.
How did you approach the heavier topics in the show? Because like I say, they're done with a real lightness of touch. You know, there's obviously stuff about debt, there's stuff about addiction, there's stuff about depression, you know. Did you know that you always wanted to talk about those, or did they just come up in the writing of, you know?
I knew that I wanted to show that, you know, that some of her failure or limitations weren't all her, you know, that life, you know, it wasn't just this woman, bundling round, getting it wrong, you know, that, you know, debt's a real thing and having to take two jobs or three jobs are real things. And so I wanted to show that debt for me was a real, it's a real life thing. People experience, you know, and it's very easy to say, follow your dreams. And you go, I'm 10 grand and 20 grand in debt. Like, it's impossible. What you're saying to me is impossible. And so I wanted that heaviness to be, and a past, and it was something, I was in debt in my 20s, and I remember that feeling, that crushing feeling of, you know, I have to not, you know, who am I to follow my dreams now when I'm in debt, you know? And addiction is something, you know, I'm familiar with, and I think every family has people with addiction in them. And so I just wanted to sort of, you know, in a funny and light way, because it wasn't never meant to be a gritty, it's not a gritty drama, you know, but I wanted to still feel like, just because it's a comedy doesn't mean it can't deal with those topics. You can still have those characters in, because they're in our lives, whether we're in good moods or bad moods, you know, we're still in debt on a good day or a bad day. You still got someone in your family with addiction on a good day or a bad day, or, you know, and so I wanted the world to feel as close to real, you know, like real people with real problems and real family issues and money problems and romantic relationship problems, you know, that any one life can have, that it's not just someone who isn't very good at managing her life.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, mate.
I will say, I do think as well that it feels like less of a burden when you see someone on screen dealing with those things that you've dealt with yourself, that you're like, I've been that person, and it feels like something's lifted from you to be able to see that experience sort of come back at you and be able to handle it in a way that, you know, That's why you're rooting for Marcella, ultimately. Aww. There's a couple of interesting things, I think, that you did in the show that I want to talk about before we move on. Women existing as their own storylines. So I'd love to talk about the mum speech with the conch, because that's such a great moment in Game Face. But I'll let you set it up as to sort of what it is.
There's an intervention for Marcella's brother, Billy, who's on cocaine. And it's sort of very badly arranged. Billy's had to arrange his own intervention, basically, because Marcella's family are sort of chaotic and not very functional, like a lot of families. And Marcella's got a sort of competitive relationship with her brother for her mum's attention, you know, and he's like the golden boy. And Marcella always feels a little bit that, you know, Billy can never get told off without her getting dragged into it. And there's sort of a bit where, you know, everyone's sort of saying their bit to Billy, and the mum has to start saying the thing, you know, how she feels, and everyone's a bit dismissive, and they're like, all right, mum, you know, we get it, like, and she gives a speech, and it's Pauline McGlynn, so she's amazing, she's a brilliant actress, brilliant comedy actress, you know, you learn so much working with someone like her, she's incredible, but it's quite dramatic, it's not meant to be that funny, this bit, and yeah, and she just has a bit about that she doesn't want to be the B story in her own life, and sort of that. Yeah, it was nice. It wasn't too long. It wasn't too... I felt like we earned a bit from her, you know, for her to sort of have that, because she's playing like the mum, the loving mum, how we see, because it's very much Marcella's version of her mum, this loving mum, you know, who the character centres around Marcella's needs, you know, and then you just get a flash of, oh my God, mums are people too.
Yeah. And it made you realise how rarely it happens. And it's such a great speech that you wrote and she performed. And did you get a lot of people coming back to you, Seth? Because I'm sure I saw tweets, because I think I'm in that episode when that went out, going, the mum speech, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people really landed with, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's, you know, we're all self-absorbed, you know, as people, and I speak for myself mainly, but, you know, and our parents, we can be in so much judgment, like Marcella is, you know, it's about, you know, I grew up in a chaotic house and all of that. There's a lot of judgment, but they, in this series, the mum, you know, she's there for it. She's got one child who's, you know, on cocaine, the other child who's sort of very self-absorbed because she hasn't got this career, and she's feeling very sorry for herself because her relationship, and, you know, sort of not really functioning, and wants to be like an actress, a successful actress. And I think this mum just wants her kids to be okay, and she's just like saying, I just want you to be okay, for God's sake, like, I put all these years in.
Yeah,
can you not just be okay? You don't have to be, your life doesn't have to be amazing, you know, like, why can't okay suit you? It suited me, sort of thing, you know?
And where can she exist in the spaces of the hugeness of your problems and Billy's problems, Marcella and Billy's?
Totally. Like,
where am I in amongst all of this? And also with my character, with Tanya, you did a really lovely...
Who you play amazingly, by the way.
Thanks. So if we're doing it, I'll take a phrase.
Absolutely incredible. You're incredible work.
But I do all of the kind of things that you sort of subverted a trope, really, didn't you, with Tanya?
Yeah, well, I wanted it to be, you know, so you've got this ex, you know, Marcella's got an ex, and then he's got a new love. And the obvious thing is to sort of be this, like, you know, absolute opposite to Marcella, kind of 2D character, so that the audience know who they're rooting for, that Marcella's, you know, the winner in the love off, so to speak, you know. But I just thought, it's, you know, life's complicated. And I really do believe fundamentally that people are all innately good, and everyone's the lead in their own story, obviously. And so I thought it'd be interesting to do it where he hasn't gone for someone who's, you know, people always think we look alike, physically dissimilar to Marcella. But more than that, sort of the chaoticness Marcella has, sort of, you know, that seems to follow her a bit, follows Tanya, you know, she gets, I don't want to give anything away, but there's, you know, when we first meet her, she's the same, got the same energy as Marcella, the sort of bundle of, you know, stuff happens to her. She's like bang into the room, and she's sweet, and she's kind, and she's vulnerable, and she's funny. And that you can see when you know, there's a bit where she does, you know, she's buying condoms and she's funny to Marcella, and Marcella just looks even more, you know, like, I can't handle
that's
that.
That's my
as
thing.
Well.
That's my yeah. thing. You can't have that. Yeah.
I wanted the audience to feel conflicted. You know, you want them to feel like, you know, Marcella, you know, the second series, she does act badly. You know, like, the end result is someone, you know, there is a victim, and there is a, and I think Tanya is, a really good character, and I really liked the way you performed her and brought her to life, and just sort of made it a bit more complex. It was just, it makes it complicated when the audience don't know what they're meant to think about. They're like, well, because they like her, and that's really important, because Marcella's a likable character, not all the time, but, you know, she's a lead in the show, so you sort of, But then you bring someone in, they go, but I like her. Like, oh, and then you go, yeah. So now it's just the situation. You get to watch sort of characters not behave that well, because that's life sometimes.
Yeah. And it feels very real because that, and I think everyone had great story and funny moments and stuff as well. You're very generous with doling out.
You're very kind, Tiffany. You're brilliant. And you're an absolute incredible actress. And honestly, this is a bit for the listener, but I don't care, I'm gonna say it. She came on set and you're just like, there's one scene in the series, in the first episode of series two, and you're just like, bang, straight, like first take. I was like, what are you made of? How are you able to do that in like the first take? But yeah, incredible.
What are your personal tiny revolutions? So things that you've discovered or processes that make a huge difference to your life or creativity? Because we always talk about, I suppose people always talk about what their morning routines are. I often think about this within creativity, that you go, Hemingway went for a walk in the morning, or Trumbo wrote in the bath. What are your own revolutions where you were like, oh, that's a light bulb moment that actually approaching the work or approaching doing stuff in this way is helpful?
Well, I'd say the most important was getting sober.
Right. Okay. Well, that's pretty huge.
Sobriety was pretty, that was a big old revolution for me. Yeah, that was massive because it just meant, firstly, you know, I got mornings back, number one. And you just so, you have so, your mood is, you know, if you're not hungover or whatever, your mood is much more level for longer periods of time, and you're feeling, you have access to feelings, and it was huge, I think. You know, being present is so important as, you know, artists and, you know, as I know, comedians, writers, creators, all of the things, to be present, because that's where all the work happens. But for me personally, what got me into wanting to do all these things was to be not present. So I'd go into my dreamland in my head and create worlds and universes and you know, imagined things, you know, and so that balance was never there for me. And I think getting sober sort of sent me back to almost being a child, that pure presence. Not all the time, but I can get pure presence and that creativity that you get when you're really present. You know, when you're sort of like, you're not trying to change, you're not trying to get out of your head. You're trying to stay in there and have a little root round, and it's okay. That sounds so waffly, but just in terms of...
No, I think it makes total sense. You start the day in a neutral space, in a more neutral emotional, and that you have access, you're not letting your emotions run you, you're steering the car a little bit more rather than someone else is driving.
Yeah, and it made me feel sort of like a teenager again, like sort of, because, you know, you're not drinking wine, or you're not hungover or whatever. And so in terms of my work, I don't know, it made me feel that sort of butterfly. Even now I can sort of tune into it, that butterfly feeling, like of creativity, of going into a space of presence. I think it's just presence, it's pure presence, that everything that you create happens in pure presence. For me, when I am at the end result, trying to constantly see the end result without doing the process, I'm ruining it. I can't, because I'm trying to dictate how it should come out and how it should end. Or yeah, it has to be present. It has to be okay with it not being great yet. And that's okay. You know, working through, so presence for me is such a huge, so meditation, so sobriety is my most recent huge revolution. There's a more sort of prosaic, rudimentary, is the Pomodoro technique, which I'll tell you about,
yes,
which is writing for 25 minutes, 5 minute break, writing for 25 minutes, 5 minute break. And that seems to, like the amount of books and workshops and, you know, kind of cottages I've rented, running off, trying to finish. And
tricking our brains into the idea that we're not working.
Totally. And then this 25 minute, like with this noise going, and you can't do anything else. You can't go to the fridge. You can't sort of answer an email. And just doing it, I get loads done. Whatever that does, the period of time, 25 minutes, I can do the piece of work that I don't want to do. I can work through a script knot. I can work through the voice in my head saying, you're not going to be able to fix this, it's not any good. I can do that for 25 minutes. And only because I know the 25 minutes is going to end. And so it's a very, like I say, rudimentary sort of, but it really...
But it's overriding all your own processes, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes, 100%.
To get to a point of not automatic, but almost like, was it the basal ganglia or whatever? There's that bit of your... brain that goes on autopilot or is that does stuff without thinking about it. And it's why when you're driving or walking, sometimes you come up with loads of ideas and stuff. And I think that's part of maybe why we feel like sitting down and doing a thing is like mad to us, because you're like, well, I can't think of anything if I'm just sitting down, if I'm doing something else. Like, but actually sometimes you do just have to. I've used the Pomodoro a few times. I should use them more, but they are really, really good. And also 25 minutes is such a good amount of time, because half an hour sounds long.
Yes.
So keeping it in under the half hour gives you, but also going, I could knock, there's no reason that I can't knock out four or five of these in a day.
It just frees my day up. I mean, it frees my brain before the committee in my little brain get to run down and tell me like I'm dog shit and I don't do good work.
Yeah.
I've already done my 25 minutes. And then they're just waking up like, whoa, what? She got something done in that 25 minutes. But I didn't get Dan to whisper in her ear that she's rubbish. You know, how did she do that? You know, so it's that tricking. Like, I remember once I was going to the theatre, and this is when I sort of had a real revelation. I was going to the theatre, and because I go to the theatre, just so you know. And I was going to the theatre, and it was like 4 o'clock. And I was like, well, I should start getting ready soon. I was like, you could get a Pomodoro, a round of, you know, 4-25 minutes. And I thought, well, no, that's mad. I'm going. But I was like, yeah, you can do that. You can, I literally, and it felt like so doable. But not how I write. Normally, like, you know, I'm up all night, I'm up all day staring at the screen, you know, kind of going through this, you know, maudlin, like, I can't do it. Sort of. And then I just did this and I just thought, well, I'll just do 2 pages, whatever I get done in the, you know, the 2 lots of the Pomodoro. And the next day I sort of checked it, what I'd written. I was like, that was so useful that I was able, in that 2 hours, I would have sat there for a whole day, you know, but I was able to be like, on the days where it's just not there, you go, I'm going to get up at 9 o'clock, I'm going to do one Pomodoro, and that's it, that's the day done. And if my muse doesn't show then, and it's like a trick, but you know, then but if it does, then you go, well, I might do another one at 2 o'clock. I'll see how I feel at 2, you know, kind of. And I would literally trick my brain into being like, so that I didn't wake up the heavy hitters of the heavy hitter, you know, self-doubt, in the committee, who are like the big ones who come down and like run down the stairs the second they think you're doing big jobs. Like, she's doing big jobs down the stairs. Like, hello, shithead, you can't write shit. Like, it's like they don't wake up for some reason. The Pomodoro gets in under them. You know, taking the pressure off, like enjoying writing. I don't, you know, there's that famous quote, I don't know who said it, but I don't enjoy writing, I enjoy having written. And that's it. When I took that off, I was like, yeah, like there's resistance. This isn't, there's never going to be this perfect time. I always remember I sort of would be obsessed with Maine. You've heard me on about this. Yeah. Like, anytime I've got a deadline, I think, oh, I need to go to Maine and buy white linen.
What's Stephen and King, like, done to you? Yeah.
But like, that's where I think writing happens. Like, writers wear white linen. They write on a beach and they do have a coffee and they sort of have a dog. They're not smoking 20 fags, phoning their agent saying, give them the money back. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of. Which I don't do anymore because I don't smoke cigarettes. But you know, that sort of idea, because I felt like writing scripted and, you know, it can be a lonely and it could be, and you have to just work out that it's not a nice feeling in the process, and that's fine. It's just okay to, it can bring up a lot of your wounds of not being good enough, and that's okay. And you have to just work out tools to work around that. So, you know, but that's a great thing. What's that phrase? Someone said, like, whatever stops you doing the work is the work.
Right.
So you get to learn sort of a lot about yourself when you try and do something. You get to learn where your resistance is and how you really feel about your own abilities.
For me, deadlines are a big thing as well. It was just that I had an appointment the other day, and because I had an appointment, I'd got up, I'd exercised, and I'd done all of my emails before I went out. Because I knew if I didn't do them all before I went to the appointment, I'd just come back and the day's gone.
Yeah.
Like, but I was like, oh, that deadline, I respond quite well to deadline. Yeah. I think that I don't, because I will fight it and I'll try and extend it and I'll do all of the things. But also just kind of knowing that there's an expectation of being somewhere or doing a thing or putting a thing.
Totally. It's part of the creative process. I wish it wasn't for me, but you know, nothing like me getting on a train to Edinburgh sets my old, when I've got 35 minutes of a show written, sets my old brain on, you know, kind of. And even now, like, I just try not to be in so much judgment of it all the time, because I always think there's other people and they've got a better process than me and they're able to do it this way and that way. And mine is the deadline as annoying as it is, has become part of the creative process. Whatever it does, it sets off a lot of fear, a lot of judgment, a lot of, I'm not going to be able to do this, I don't want to do this. It just is part of it. It's intertwined with it, you know, with the end result being done, being finished. And yeah, because without the deadline, nothing's getting done. I'm living in like perfect, in my head, I'm living with my perfect version of the work that I have never written. It's lovely that. Oh yeah, this lovely bit of work sitting up there in my brain. Oh, it's lovely. Yeah, I've never had to work through it. So deadlines are part of the creative process, I would say. And I feel like these things that we can see as threats and as things that, for me, I look at deadline like, why do you want to hurt me though? You know, what did I ever do to you, deadline? You know, like, sort of. But when you are able to use it as a tool, as which I now go, oh yeah, the deadline's coming as it approaches, and then I'll have the night, dark night of the soul around the work, which is normally I try and change everything about it and set it in Peru. And then I'm like, you know, and then
just you and Paddington Bear.
Pretty much. I'm like, why have I written this show about this? I should have written a period drama set in Spain. Like, I was, like, you know, like, there's tools in even in things that are frightening. You know, there are things that, like, feel like they're impending.
Well, they feel like getting close to a job, and none of us wanted to do a job. Like, yes. So anything yes. that smells like... That smells like a job. No, I yes. don't do job. I'm my own.
Yeah.
I'm my own 100%. Person. But like with Edinburgh, that deadline of just having, like you were saying, the fear on the train. I'm still now a person, and I guess we can sort of end with talking about this and maybe talking about great stuff maybe that you've seen in Edinburgh. But I can't go past Edinburgh on the train without feeling nauseous.
That's because you're always drunk up there.
Probably,
when's the
yeah.
last time you've gone past Edinburgh not drunk? No, I know what you mean. I'm being facetious. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's like you know, one of my first gigs was the Amuse Moves, and she used to play. Hill Jago used to play the song that she used to bring everyone on was "Can you hear it pumping on your stereo? Can you hear it?" And honestly, I could be in a bar in Greece or a restaurant in Greece. That song comes on, my whole body. I act like I'm about to flip the table. My whole body just seizes up with like, and all my brain keeps shouting is something's about to happen. And that takes me ages to work out. Oh no, this is what used to happen. You see, because you were going on stage. So I think Edinburgh always has that now. You know, we have that kind of
Supergrass have programmed you.
Yeah.
Deep programming.
That's it.
How important do you think it is in the bigger, the wider, talking about art and talking about revolutions? Because, you know, I remember 2010 being this bit, because I was up at the Fringe as well, this like huge moment when you won Newcomer. Like, how important do you think it is in the grand scheme of things as to have a career doing what we do and what the future of that might be?
I mean, for me, that was a huge moment because I'd been gigging for a while and it was my first solo show, and it was 10 years ago now, 11 years this year. So it was a huge moment, you know, and it's a prestigious award and all of that stuff. And I still think, you know, awards are, you know, shiny objects and accolades are nice, you know, they make you feel you're on the right track, you know, be it praise, be it an award, be it. But for me, that did change my trajectory because I was able to, you know, go full time effectively in comedy and not sort of have to temp and stuff. And now I think Edinburgh is still that. I, you know, there's no festival in the world like Edinburgh. I think just because, you know, you could have an amazing show. I've seen amazing shows, but I've already saw four shows before. Already seen four shows before it. So I'm going in. I'm not a great audience. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm just tight. I'm full up. You know. So it's just like having a steak after, you know, a curry. You just, you're like, none of, they're both fine, but I'm just full on. So it makes, you know, you see amazing shows up there, and because there's so much competition up there, by its very nature, it's like everyone gets better for it, even if their mental health really struggles, because it is a very hard place to go up when, you know, you might have sold for 5 tickets and it costs a lot of money. And now there's a free fringe, it doesn't as much, but when we first were going up there, you know, it was always you had a debt to pay at the end. And if you're working class, explaining to your working class member why you sold out every night for your £5,000 in debt, they're just like, I don't understand this business you're in, you know. So yeah, but now I think there's so many more routes for artists, for comedians, for writers, performers, you know, playwrights, to get their work seen. And so, you know, Edinburgh isn't for, you know, it's, if you've, if you're a single parent, maybe you can't go up there for a month, you know, and bring your kids up. You know, there's, there are things that, you know, when you're younger and you're single that you don't notice, that maybe there's a lot of people like you and a lot of who look like you, and, you know, it's very middle class. And but there's lots, I'm talking around the houses. I think the great thing at the moment is the internet and is this access to so much more work and art that we could ever have imagined. You know, like, you can have a bad Edinburgh and still have an incredible, you know, that show. A bad Edinburgh, I mean, like, not a lot of people come to see your show or whatever. Yeah. And that that used to be the end of that show. But now that doesn't, you know, someone can tweet about it. Someone can say they saw your show, someone with a big following, or you can put a bit on YouTube and people are like, this is really good, actually. You know, you can find your audience, and that's liberating. And it's just, that's exciting as well, that we can all, you know, that people now want to see exactly what they want to see. So someone you've never heard of or I've never heard of could be absolutely huge, have millions and millions of followers, which never used to be the case, you know. Yeah. To that level, you know, and that's exciting that people get to, there's space for everyone, you know. There doesn't have to be like, comedy is happening in comedy now. You go in certain areas and, you know, there's comedy, you can find your comedy at a mass scale, I think, you know.
And there's less power in, it takes the power away from some of the gatekeepers, whether that be press or media up at the fringe, or whether that be TV channels and film, you know, like, it kind of means that it's your ability to be seen, which is one of the beautiful things, I suppose, about the fringe, but then you need to be able to afford to get there to be seen in the first place, is the fact that you will see wild stuff. Absolutely. Bouncy Castle Hamlet. Bouncy Castle Dracula is going on.
It's not curated. It's the only festival that's, well, not the only, but the one that, like, Montreal or Melbourne, they're curated.
Yeah.
You know, you get invited over. So no matter what, like, the worst you're going to see is middling. Whereas in Edinburgh, you can go and see a show that you're like, okay, this is happening, is it? And then you go and see another show that someone you've never heard, you might have three people in, you think this is absolutely magnificent and they're going to win something this year, you know, like, and it's incredible. And, but for me, my first Edinburgh was a tiny revolution, if we talk about tiny, because I had no awareness of it. When I got there, it literally felt like, you know, like in the film, like from the 60s, when someone takes drugs for the first time and everything goes purple. It was like, that's what, I've never taken drugs, but it was, well, you know, it was, that's what Edinburgh felt for me. I felt this kind of world that I had missed, that I didn't even know existed. That I was like, oh, it felt like coming home, the good and the bad, and my people, everything. I had such a real tiny revolution getting to Edinburgh. That festival was, I remember thinking, this is, yeah, where I'm meant to be, for sure. For the first time in my life, I knew where I was meant to be, meant to be somewhere.
Yeah, I didn't know it existed until I, like, maybe went and did the play. And I think I'd maybe started doing some open spots before that, but didn't know Edinburgh was a thing, or I'd heard of it. But yeah, it like you say, it's like kind of the turning up in Oz or whatever.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah, it was overwhelming, and all the comedy, just, you know, all the camaraderie and all, just everyone, and the noise and the smell and the city and the high ceilings of the flats and the love and the heartbreak, and it's all there. It's like, you know, and I'm so glad for it, you know. It just felt like, and just watch it and talk about comedy relentlessly and learning the language of comedy and, you know, what makes a good show and what doesn't, you know. And of course it's subjective, but learning to engage in it, like in the conversations about what you like and what you don't like at that level, you know, with people. It was so invigorating. Like, I just...
Gives you energy, doesn't it?
Devastating. And all of the feelings, it was just like, there's not one feeling that didn't come in hot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, every feeling showed up like, happy, you know, like devastated. Every day was just like, you know,
the little hope horse that I call it, that rides into town the day the nominations come out. Like, you go, I don't care, nah, but, and then the little hope horse is like, you're like, no, don't get on the hope horse, don't get, you know. And it's so hard to try and, it's like all of the stuff we've been talking about, but you're exactly right, it's condensed. It's like a montage in a film. It is like a year in a month.
Oh yeah, it's a lifetime, you know. It's a life in a month, you know. Like, it's got all of the beats of a great script, do you know what I mean? Like, there's the, you know, the beginning, the mid, like, you know, the hope, the despair, the hope, the love, you know, just so much of it is. I'm very grateful that we have that here in, you know, in the UK and in Scotland, because it is nothing's perfect, and there's, you know, it needs to be more inclusive and definitely more for working class and people of colour and stuff like that. It definitely needs to make sure that it, you know, improves that. But as a festival as a whole, the fact that, you know, it isn't curated and you don't have to ask anyone, you know, obviously you have to book the venues, but you can go up there, you know, you don't have to be seen in the sort of, in the same way that you do in Melbourne or Montreal.
Is there a show that you saw at Edinburgh in that first fringe that blew your mind?
So many, but if I'm going back, it would be Daniel Kitson, I think. It was a Daniel Kitson show. I guess it's just that it was so thoughtful and it combined raucous belly laughs with such precision introspection that I didn't think it was possible. I thought you always had to sacrifice one for the other, you know, that you had to sort of paint broadly to go big. And then if you went, you know, very introspective and very new, very detailed observations to the point of, you know, that they would be smiles and wry, but it wasn't. It was a show that it was really brilliantly smart, worn loosely, but yeah, full of heart. It was a real, I just hadn't seen him. I'd never heard of him, you know, so a lot of people, you know, I'd never seen him on TV or anything because he doesn't do TV, but it was a show that was, and you know, it was everyone, you know, in comedy, it was Kitson fever. And so, yeah, I watched that Daniel Kitson show. There's one I remember.
One of the things that sort of is always worth remembering about Kitson, because he's reviewed as, you know, like art is stand, and I believe stand up is art, you know, and he's often talked about in those kind of frames. But it's worth remembering that he came through as a club comic. That's how he, same as you, same as me, like he came through that. And I think that's forgotten sometimes, because I think sometimes club comedy is kind of like dismissed a bit or sneered at, in that it's not. And when you put Daniel in a room, you can see those chops that he can just absolutely just, he came and did Old Rope one night and it was last minute. I think you were like, try Dan, you know, cause our headliner had dropped out. So no one in the crowd was there, cause it was like Kitson, but he came in and he like surveyed the room and he was like, oh yeah, I've got to work this. This is going to be, and like him enjoying it, going right gears in. And going, I can make any, it's not just a Kitson crowd I have to make laugh. It's like you said, you didn't know anything about him and you loved it, but he has the ability to do that. And I think that's it's a great choice.
Yeah, it's one I remember. And I saw, you know, amazing. I mean, I'm probably, you know, forgetting so many amazing shows because my brain just is gone. Like, I can't remember a film I watched yesterday half the time. But that was just one I remember at the time, hearing a lot about him up there, thinking, oh, it's going to be, having an idea about what it was and thinking I'll enjoy it, but it was visceral. It was very visceral and belly laughy and smart.
Thank you for coming on Tiny Revolutions, Roisin Connerty. You've been brilliant as always.
Thank you for having me, Tiffany Stevenson, as always.
You can listen to other programmes from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Andy Bush. I'm here to tell you about our weekly board games podcast that you might just love, called Bush's Board Game Thing. Every week, me, Brian and Eloise get together, sit around a table, play a few board games and mainly just go off on massive tangents about life and stuff like that. It's less about the minutiae of the board games themselves. What we love is the fact that games bring people together and can spark conversation. Each week we have a terrible board game fact from Brian, which absolutely makes him ramble into the wall. And one of you guys get in touch to pitch us a board game that hasn't been made yet. Our favourite so far was an extremely tired dad who came up with a board game about camping and going for a wee in a hedge. Bush's Board Game Thing, give it a listen. It might just change your life.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.